You, I guess we're talking about stress energy tensors at the end of the stuff about quantum field theory. I guess I should make the connection to statistical mechanics. This energy which you see up on the blackboard, I'm not sure that you see it because I can't figure out whether my stuff goes over that, but this is the energy which is the space integral of T0, 0, and that is what we call the Hamiltonian, of course. This momentum is what we call the momentum, P. Now, there are a relativistic invariance and Galilean invariance. Galileo was one of the first people to stress that the equations of physics were invariant under Minkowski transformations, and that what we would do if we were in a moving coordinate system is not play with e to the minus beta h, beta being a parameter and h being this operator or this statistical quantity. We would play with e to the beta h minus v. Plus, I've forgotten the convention for the signs, I'm sorry to say. Beta h plus v, where v is the velocity with which the thing is moving past us, dot p, where p is exactly that momentum. So Galileo talked about what happened with ships moving along, just sort of like Einstein talked about what happened with railroad trains moving along. And if you wanted to do statistical mechanics based on a coordinate system which was moving with velocity v, you would use something sort of like this, except that you would need a nonlinear term in v squared, but I haven't written that down, because, and I'm not sure about the signs on this because I haven't prepared them. So that's the connection between the stuff that you just got and the stuff that you are getting in statistical things. Let's get this down. Okay. You all are, I'm happy to say, brighter and better prepared than I expected you all to stay there, than I expected you to be. Therefore, I'm moving somewhat faster than I expected to move, or will move somewhat faster than I expected to move. Therefore, I'm going to have to fill in more material not in the lecture notes as we go along. You'll find that some of the stuff in this outline has disappeared, and there you'll find also that I've added some stuff. But let's go back and talk about probabilities, as I promised to talk about probabilities to start out with things. We have n events divided into classes. The classes are labeled by alpha, and n alpha is the number of events in class alpha. The probability is defined to be the limit as n goes to infinity of n alpha over n. Given this definition, it is required that the sum over all possibilities of the probability be equal to 1. I haven't seen this in quantity in my readings about statistics, which are somewhat limited. But in fact, it is quite reasonable to talk about relative probabilities, which I'll indicate for a moment by the symbol R alpha. This is the relative chance that alpha will turn up. That is, we say that with fair six-sided dice, there are equal relative chances that any one of those sides would come up. And therefore, we could set the relative probability to anything which was independent of alpha. For example, we could set the relative probability to be 1 for each value of alpha. We could set a normalization, which is the sum over all alpha of the relative probabilities. And then the probability itself, rho alpha, is r alpha divided by z. You guys are all familiar with this idea from statistical mechanics. So this just repeats. We have a fair dice. All probabilities are equal. R alpha can be 1. The number of possibilities is 6. Rho alpha is 1 over 6 for all values of alpha. Moving along to stuff which I suspect is review for almost all of you. The average value of alpha, if you ask a person in a grade school or middle school what is the average, you might get, if you've got a bright person, the answer that you take the total number of cases, you divide it up, you take alpha times the number of cases of type alpha, sum over alpha, and divide by n. That's a reasonable definition of the average value of alpha. It is also, from this, a reasonable definition to take the probability of alpha turning up times alpha summed over alpha. In fact, this is the basis of sort of everything in probability theory. The average of anything is the probability that it will turn up times the value when it does turn up. We then can calculate the average value of alpha squared, the average value of the fluctuations in alpha, the variance in alpha, which is alpha minus the expectation value of alpha. That square is absolute nonsense. It doesn't exist. It isn't there. Alpha minus the average value of alpha, the variance is in alpha is alpha minus the average value of alpha squared and averaged. This last quantity is called the variance of alpha. The general rule is to calculate the average of any function of anything. You take that function, you multiply it by, you take the value of f of alpha, you multiply it by the probability, and you sum. Then there are questions for people who want to ask themselves whether they understand what this is all about. I'm ready to answer any question about this or anything else, but I'm also ready to go on. On. Come on. Thank you. Okay. Now imagine that we're looking at two different things described by alpha and beta. They are different, maybe correlated, maybe not. For example, alpha might describe the temperature on some day. Beta might describe the probability of rain on the day before. These are correlated quantities. They are described as having probabilities, rho alpha for 1, and rho prime, the prime saying is a different thing, sub beta for the other. Both kinds of events are complete. That is, the sum over all possibilities for both kinds of events equal to 1. To repeat myself, the prime indicates that the two probabilities are quite different from one another. They're different things. Let rho alpha beta be the probability that both things will happen. It will both rain and turn out to be rho 0 is that it will turn out to be 0 degrees. So rho alpha beta is the probability that both things will happen. The technical name for this is a joint probability. The joint probability requires that the sum over all possibilities of this joint probability is equal to 1. So far, nothing hard has happened. This one is a little bit hard to think about. Rho alpha with a line and then beta is the probability that event alpha occurs if we know that event beta has or will occur. This is called a conditional probability, the probability that alpha will occur conditioned on beta. It obeys the relation that rho alpha beta is equal to the joint probability divided by the probability of occurrence of the beta type event. Since something must happen, the sum over alpha of rho alpha beta for each and every value of beta is equal to 1. I stand there and just look at the screen for a bit, because some of you are going to want to look at the screen for a bit. This joint probability is the new idea. It is called rho alpha beta. It is the probability that both things happen. The next new idea is rho alpha conditioned on beta. That is the probability that alpha will turn up, given that we already know that beta has turned up. This is called the conditional probability. Onward. Questions? No questions. Onward. Independent events. Now, this is a fundamental idea from physics. Physics says that we can consider things which are separated from one another, things which are independent of one another. When Galileo talked about something falling from the Tower of Pisa, maybe, yes, he talked about it, not clear that he did anything, but when he talked about something falling from the Tower of Pisa, he wasn't caring what was going on in Rome. He wasn't caring about anything. He said that the falling off of the Tower of Pisa was an event independent of all of the things that were happening in other parts of Italy. The fact that we can separate the world into independent events is important for our formulation of physics. This idea of independent events could be stated in terms of conditional probabilities. If alpha is statistically independent of beta, then rho alpha beta is independent of beta. You notice that the word independent has been used in several different senses. That is, there is the mathematical concept of independent, namely, that as we change the value of beta in this conditional probability, rho alpha beta, which is a number, it doesn't change, or set of numbers doesn't change. This is the definition of statistical independence. And that definition turns out to mean that rho alpha beta, the joint probability, is simply the product of the individual probabilities. That's what it means to have things be statistically independent. Equivalently, two events are statistically independent of the number of times both shows up appears as a product. The number of times that alpha and beta show up is the number of times that alpha shows up times the number of times that beta shows up divided by the total number of events. This can be generalized, of course, to any number of events, m different events. M different events are statistically independent if the joint probabilities of the outcome of all of these events is simply the product of the m individual probabilities. The word uncorrelated is also used to describe statistically independent events. Again, I think not new stuff for most of you. I should point out, and will point out probably more than once, Question, question. Yes, please.
The N there, the capital N, is a bit confusing to me because A and B are said to be independent, so they have different sample space. So what is that big N that I'm presenting now?
I'm sorry, my ears aren't as good as they should be. But also my finger isn't doing the right thing. Do I have the right formula? The right formula says that the sum over alpha and beta of n alpha beta is going to be equal to the total number of events. That is, if I have 100 events, the sum of this over both alpha and beta should add up to 100. The sum over n alpha adds up to 100. The sum over n prime beta over beta adds up to 100. N is 100. 100 times 100 divided by 100 is 100. Do it once more. N alpha beta is the number of times alpha turns up times the number of times beta turns up divided by n. The sum over alpha and beta, n alpha beta, is the total number of times something happens. It's the sum over alpha and alpha, the sum over beta and beta, and n. N squared over n, left-hand side equals right-hand side. I don't think.
The question was just that we are having two independent events, so we can take 100 as a sample space and 200 as a sample space.
The other side. So the, do we need to take the same number of event, the number of events in the two sample spaces since they are independent events?
I'm thinking of as my example, this example of what happens with the rain at the end of last year and the temperature at the beginning of this year. Then I'm thinking of the case in which we have the same number of both kinds of events. You can, however, think of a different case in which this sum is different from that sum. And of course, you get the same kind of theorem. It's just a little bit different. OK? Thank you. Continuing. Simple outcome. A simple outcome can happen only one way, like two coming up when we throw one single die. Only one way it can happen. If we have a fair die, if we have a fair die with two on only one face, it only comes out once, only one way, and the probability of that with a fair die is 1/6. A complex outcome can happen several ways, like seven coming up. Seven could come up with the first die coming up at 3, and the second die with 4, or the first one with 5 and the second one with 2, or the first one with 4 and the second one with 3. There are lots of ways that 7 can come up, and we have to figure out the probability of a complex outcome as a sum of probabilities of simple outcomes. Lots of such summation is done in statistical physics. If simple outcomes are equally likely, the probability of complex outcome of a complex outcome is the number of different simple outcomes times the probability of a single simple event. This is the sort of counting one does. The number of ways that something can happen is denoted by the symbol capital W. Entropy is given by S. Well, entropy is given by S, that's the symbol for entropy, is Boltzmann's constant times the logarithm of W. Boltzmann wanted everybody to know that this was his formula. He made it known by having it, by asking that it be put on his tombstone. And he committed suicide. I guess he was in a rush to get it on his tombstone. In any case, this is a formula in which the entropy is the logarithm of the number of outcomes is on Boltzmann's tombstone, and it is a fundamental formula from statistical mechanics. Okay. What's the minimum value of S? That's the third law of thermodynamics. The minimum value of S is zero. That is, the minimum number of ways stuff can come, something can happen is one. And at zero temperature, we fall into a unique ground state in which only one thing can happen, and then we get entropy zero. Can you think of a way of getting entropy values lower than zero? I have seen entropy values listed to be lower than zero. Can you think of how that might happen? Please.
A little confused.
Okay.
In a discrete system with a discrete state space, it's true that the minimum value of W is one. In statistical mechanics, we generally use a continuous phase space, and
let's go back one, because the third law of thermodynamics is real. In statistical mechanics, we often think about quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, we have a discrete state space. And so it is true that there is a third law of thermodynamics, which is generally stated as the minimum value of the entropy is zero, and that as things get very cold, generally things fall to zero entropy. If I take a piece of anything, in pure substance, and bring it down to zero temperature, the entropy is supposed to get smaller and smaller and end up at zero. Nonetheless, there are ways in which you can get something that you might call the entropy, which is below zero, in fact, negative. Nobody saw that for work. Set of outcomes which are discrete, but imagine what is the probability that something will happen. If the probability that something will happen is considerably less than one, then we describe it as having an entropy which is negative. That is, we can get probabilities which go down as low as we like, and if we want to normalize probabilities based upon a set of likely events, then very unlikely events will turn out to have a negative entropy. Okay. Finishing up on probabilities. Given two fair dice, we could ask what's the sum and product of what turns up. You can do that for yourself, or perhaps you might be asked it for your homework. I'm not doing much about running the homework part of the course. Given two dice independent of one another, one fair and the other one unfair, you might ask how you would describe the probabilities of the outcome of throwing both dice together. What's the total chance of rolling a 7 or an 11 with fair dice? We will answer, roughly speaking, the question, if we roll 100 dice all at the same time, what's the average sum of dice values and how we can define a root mean square fluctuation in the value. We will answer that question and answer it reasonably explicitly. I'll come back to that. So at this point, from my point of view, we are done with probabilities. I will answer questions, but I assume So the fundamentals of probability are known to all of them. As pointed out by this gentleman, whose name I don't recall. Please tell me your name, sir.
Aaron.
As pointed out by Aaron, we often talk not about discrete outcomes, but continuous outcomes. For example, in quantum mechanics, if we have a wave function psi of x, as Aaron pointed out, we can have a probability that we will lie within a interval dx around the point x, which is psi of x squared dx. Psi of x squared is a discrete probability density or probability distribution. That definition of a probability distribution is that the rho of x dx is the probability that x will turn out to be within dx of the point x. That's a lot of x's in one sentence, but I think you all understand what that means. In general, we use the notation rho of x for probability density. So probability for finding a particle between x and x plus dx that obeys the normalization condition that the integral over all x of this thing is equal to 1. For example, as you all know, in classical statistical mechanics, the probability density for finding a particle with x component of momentum equal to p is a normalization constant times an exponential of minus beta p squared over 2m, where p is the momentum and m is the mass of the particle. This is called the Gaussian probability distribution after the mathematician Gauss. Okay. I've gone fast over this, but this is review for, I think, almost all of you. If anyone wants to slow me down, if anyone wants to ask a question, if anyone wants to point out an error in what I've done, please do so. Okay. Now, statistical mechanics is about many things at the same time. We already talked about the word independent. Independent, if we have two different kinds of events labeled by alpha and beta, independent means that rho alpha beta is a product, rho alpha times rho prime beta. This product form is a characteristic form, a characteristic way of representing independence. Independence is a concept which can be represented in different ways, and in probabilities, it is represented by a product. In physics, we are used to the idea that we have concepts, often symmetry concepts, which are represented in various ways. For example, a vector is a representation of a concept of rotation. Products like this are representations of the concept of independence. There is another very simple representation of the concept of independence. If now a bunch of spins are independent of one another, and here I'm using alpha in a way which is conceptually different from the way that I used it here. My apologies. But there is a limitation to the alphabet. And furthermore, I'm so used to doing it this way that I actually didn't think until I walked up to here that I was using something which is quite inconsistent. Namely, if the Hamiltonian is a sum of terms which represent individual kinds of things, then we say that the individual kinds of things are independent of one another. For example, if we have a material with many atoms, and each atom has its own spin, and those spins don't interact, then we might have a Hamiltonian which is the sum of from alpha equals 1 to n of some constant times sigma alpha. And we might have, or rather, let me use a more reasonable notation. We might have minus beta times h is the sum over alpha of h times sigma alpha. And then went backwards. Let's go forwards again. And then we would have a probability distribution with e to the minus beta h over a normalization, and 1 over a normalization of partition functions, times the product from alpha equals 1 up to n of e to the dimensionless magnetic field times sigma alpha. The point being that a summational representation of independence here turns into a product representation of independence here and here. The product here is an indication that the different pieces are statistically independent of one another. The partition function, then, is the product from alpha equals 1 to n of the sum over the sigma values of the exponential of the Hamiltonian for each sigma value. It is a, then, each one of these terms is the cosine, the hyperbolic cosine of h. There are n of such terms in the product, so it's 2 cosh h to the n. So the partition function for the whole thing is the partition function for the individual piece raised to the nth power. If you have independent and identical things, the partition function for the whole story is the partition function for the piece raised to the power n, where n is the number of pieces. And the probability distribution for the whole guy is the product of probability distributions for the individual guys, each probability distribution normalized by small z. The appearance of a product structure depends only upon having a Hamiltonian, which is the sum of terms referring to individual parts of the system. So the Hamiltonian being a sum means the statistical mechanics probability is a product, and both of these are representations of the same fact of statistical independence. Yes, please.
Is there any significance to the fact that alpha is in the superscript there sometimes or subscript other times?
Hardly any. That is, no. That is, this is my sloppiness. This, the difference between this and right there should be regarded as an error.
Okay.
So one for, score up one for your side. So I make bigger and more important errors. We only got a little more, but we'll find bigger and more important errors. Okay. Note how this very same structure, which applies to one atom, exponential of minus beta times the Hamiltonian divided by normalization, carries over equally to many atoms. This way of carrying over from one to many, or carrying over as we make a change, is called a structural invariance. It is a property of a good, exciting, interesting, worthwhile theory that it has a structural invariance. It is physicists, mathematicians too, get all wet in the eyes about structural invariance. They say it's a wonderful property. It's an indication of something being correct, or at least being very, very important. Structural invariance is characteristic of the mathematical basis of physical theories. Newton's gravitational theory seemed natural because the very same law which applied to one apple, namely inverse square proportional force proportional to mass, applies equally to an entire planet composed of apples. You add apples and apples and apples, and you get apples, or rather, you get planets with the same law. That's considered to be great. Same thing works for electromagnetism. A wave function is the same sort of thing for one electron or many. The structure of space and time has a similar invariance property. A little bit of distance and a lot of distance are basically the same thing. To be corny, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. The similarity between a single step and a longer distance is a kind of structural invariance. This is called a scale invariance, and it's kind of important in physics. Okay. We're getting towards the end of things which are all hand-waving, and we're getting down to the start of work. Work starts in statistical mechanics with Maxwell and Boltzmann and Gaussian statistical variables. A Gaussian random variable, capital X, I will try to use capital X to represent a random variable and small x to represent its value. However, just like I'm not going to get my subscripts and superscripts right, I'm not going to get my capital X's and small x's right. But that's something you can catch me on and try to make me more consistent. For example, this capital X should, I think, be a small x. A Gaussian random variable is one which has a probability distribution, which is an exponential of a quadratic. That is, rho of x is some normalization factor, which I presume is right here, times an exponential of minus beta. Beta is one, it's called 1 over the variance of the distribution, times x minus the average value of the Gaussian random variable squared divided by 2. This 2 and this 2 are both conventional and are convenient in this kind of thing. The sum of, okay, there is a structural invariance property here. The sum of two statistically independent Gaussian variables is also a Gaussian variable. And you might scribble on a piece of paper and ask yourself, how does the variance add up if we're adding two Gaussian random variables? Gaussian variables, I've already said, is an extreme example of a structurally stable quantity. Now, here comes an important theorem. If we have X, a random variable, being a sum of a very large number of random variables, I will walk away from my usual convention and call these variables small y sub alpha. Each one of these guys is a random variable, and each one is small in the sense that it's y alpha squared average is less than infinity. We have lots of these guys, and they add up to a variable like this. And these guys are all the same. That is, the result is independent of alpha. This y alpha squared is independent of alpha. Each one of these variables is like each one of the others. Then this, in the limit as n goes to infinity, is always a Gaussian variable. This is a structural property that Gaussian variables have. I'll back up and go back. go back. Sum of a large number of individually quite small random variables need not be small. And the individual small variables need not be Gaussian, nor need they be the same as I said they were here. But that sum is, to a good approximation, a Gaussian variable, given only that the variance of the individual variables is bounded and no one of those variables dominates the sum. A Gaussian distribution has lots of structurally invariant properties. Nope, we saw that before, I don't quite know. Life is hard. Oh, we're going backwards, that's what's happening. But we haven't seen this one. Gaussian is a term that's applied to lots of stuff. A Gaussian integral is an integral of an exponential with a quadratic, a linear term, and a constant term integrated over x. X might be a single variable. X might be a whole vector of variables, in which case A is a matrix. X might be a complex number, in which case this is the magnitude squared, usually. X might be lots of stuff. And always the theory is sort of the same. The way you do integrals of this kind is that you go back to the a situation in which you have a simple square, that's called completing the square, by shifting the origin of integration. And you try to then construct a structure which looks like this, x minus the average value of x squared times something. And that then gives you something which you can integrate by so-called completing the square. For Gaussian probability distributions, there's a very important result. E to the iqx is of this form. It's the average e to the iq times the average value of x times a quadratic structure, q squared, times 1 over 2 beta. Notice the beta is in the numerator here and is in the denominator there. OK. Let me figure out something about you all. How many of you would regard this as a familiar result? Everybody? Oh my gosh. People were just rushing along here. Thank you. Okay. Let me try this out in a different way. Let's see how many would regard. I have a couple of homework problems, and you may very well have done the homework problems. So let me ask about them. OK. Let me imagine that I have a Hamiltonian, which is x squared plus y squared over 2, that's e to the minus beta. Plus k times xy plus k times yx. E to the minus beta h, put a minus sign there and there. I'd like to know what the partition function is, what the average of x squared is, and what the average of x minus y squared is. Is this familiar to you all? Have you done this problem? Well, you're gonna, because it's a homework problem. OK, so let me write it out more This one is a complete the square problem, and there's not so much to it. But what an awful lot of what we do in statistical physics and what is done, in fact, in field theory is playing around with variables by completing the squares. So, minus sign, plus sign, plus sign, right. I'm going, so this is a homework problem. I'm going to ask, what is the partition function? What is the value of the average of x squared? What's the value of the average of x minus y squared? And in each case, what is the form of the singularity in K? I promise you it is singular in K, that there is a region of K, including K equals 0, for which this is a reasonable problem. And there's a region of K for which the integrals diverge. And I want to know the form of the singularity as k approaches the boundary of the region in which it converges. OK, that's one. And that's number two. Number two is a formalization of number one. So let's take beta times the Hamiltonian is on a lattice. The sum over r of phi sub r squared divided by 2. If I wrote this as I guess I'd like to, as phi over r, this is a sort of typical field theory problem. And I want to make this so that the thing converges. And then I would imagine that, let me see exactly what I did here. Yes, plus a sum over nearest neighbors of coupling phi of r times phi of s. And this is a sum over nearest neighbors. In fact, this is slightly too hard for you. Not much, but slightly. So I'm going to ask for a more formal and easier problem. So beta h is equal to the sum over r of phi of r times phi of s, so sum over r and s, of something which I will just write as g to the minus 1 of r and s. If you want to interpret that as the inverse of a Green's function, you're quite welcome to do so. This is at the inverse of a matrix G plus I H sub R times phi of R. And this is a 1/2, so that I don't count everything twice. And I'm going to ask the question of what is the value of phi of R. And at H equals 0, what is the value of the average of phi of r times phi of s? This is not hard because I happen to find a g of r and s. And that means that you can consider g to be the inverse of a Green's function and define everything in terms of the Green's function of which g is the inverse. That means this is simply a formal problem. Yes?
Would these be posted?
Excuse me?
Would these problems be posted then?
Will these problems be posted then?
Well, yeah, I will post them.
Fine. The problems will be posted. The thing will fit into the usual system. These are in some sense, the bread and butter problems of this course. You'll show up again in some sense in every set of lectures in this course. Just like I, when I teach everything except for this course, I think, this particular course, put a string of oscillators along a line in everything. It's part of a statistical mechanics course, it's part of a quantum mechanics course, it's part of a classical mechanics course. These two problems are the absolute bread and butter of what the theoretical physicists do with their time. And what you all will be doing with your time as well. Where did I put my clicker? Here's my clicker. Okay. So I decided that you all were well enough trained and intelligent enough so that you could do all of these things for yourself without our holding your hand too much and then make a good homework assignment. Okay. According to Boltzmann, whose name I've mentioned, and Maxwell, whose name you've heard a bunch of other times in other contexts, the probability distribution for a particle in a weakly interacting gas is given by e to the minus beta h, and h being p squared over 2m plus a potential. In fact, I guess momentum was not a concept that Maxwell had much use for, so that this is modern notation for stuff that they did, they said in different ways in the old days. Here, the potential holds the particles in a box of volume omega, so that we take the potential to be zero inside the volume and infinite outside of it. As usual, we go after the thermodynamic properties by calculating the partition function. Z is the integral over coordinates and momenta of the e to the minus beta times this Hamiltonian. I can do the integral over coordinates trivially. I know that I get zero for the integrand outside the volume, and I get a contribution which is essentially a unity inside the volume, so I get a factor of the volume multiplying this partition function. Here it is. And then I have to do the integral over the three momentum p of e to the minus beta times the three momentum squared divided by 2m. Or I can say that I have to do an integral over a single momentum p cubed. That is, I have to do this same integral three times and multiply the results. I get the result, the volume of the system times 2 pi m over beta to the 3/2. That is, I am making use of the fact, which should be well known to all of us, that the integral dx, which can't, maybe well known, but you can't read it, many of you, so I will put it up here. Okay, I don't even have to do that. Here I'm making use of the value of a Gaussian integral, which should be well known to all of us, either by the time we, either when we get started in the course, or by the time you get to this far in the course. Here is the value of the partition function for that Hamiltonian, and in the usual way, by differentiating the partition function with respect to beta, or rather logarithm of the partition function, we find out that the average energy is 3/2 kT. These guys, Boltzmann and Maxwell and their buddies, knew that in any classical system, you get a 1/2 kT for any quadratic degree of freedom. The coordinate thing is not a quadratic degree of freedom. It is something which just gives us this factor of omega. But each component of the momentum gives us a quadratic degree of freedom and gives us a 1/2 kT in the average energy. This is what this sentence says. The classical result is that the average energy contains a term 1/2 kT for each quadratic degree of freedom. Thus, a harmonic oscillator, which is x squared plus p squared, or x squared plus p squared over 2m, or kx squared plus p squared over 2m, doesn't matter, has an average energy, which is 1/2 kT plus 1/2 kT, or kT. OK. You all asked, one of you asked, I can't remember which one of you, but what do you do with a calculation of the action, the end of the last hour, that is, the end of the hour containing the field theory? The logarithm of z is exactly like the action. It is essentially like the vacuum energy, which is what you get from the action. This is important. Once you get this quantity, you're prepared to find out a lot more about the behavior of the system. Furthermore, exactly this quantity, exactly the vacuum energy, is what drives dark matter and what gives you what drives dark energy and gives you a lot of stuff in modern cosmology. Okay, so this stuff says how we calculate 3/2 kT. More or less, you all know about it. We take the partition function, we take its logarithm, we take the logarithm of z with respect to beta, and you get minus the average energy. That's the usual way of calculating an average energy, which is the logarithm of, take the logarithm of the partition function and differentiate it with respect to beta. In fact, I'm now just proving what I said before, that the partition function, or its equivalent, the action, is an important thing. Here we're using it to calculate the average energy of the system. If we take the second derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to beta squared, which is the derivative of the energy with respect to beta, with a minus sign, that quantity is called the specific heat, and that specific heat is an important thermodynamic quantity. It is also it is the mean square fluctuations in the energy. I think I will give this to you as the third homework problem. Let n particles be confined to a box of volume omega. The derivative with respect to omega of the logarithm of the partition function is minus beta p. What do you think are the value of the root mean square fluctuations in the pressure? That may require a little bit of looking up things in books. Okay, what are we doing this time? Oh. Okay, it says I should do two variables, do n variables. I do this. I should tell you that they are complete the square exercises. I told you that. For the one with the inverse Green's function, I think I'm hinting that you should do formal linear algebra on n variables, but I already did that. And within one, okay, let me see. I'm supposed to go for another 15 minutes, right? Yes, another 15 minutes. So I have another topic that we're beginning with. This is a good place to pause and ask whether you have any questions or comments. Okay. Here is the first point at which we progress beyond 19th century physics, I think. I may be wrong. We may have progressed beyond 19th century physics in other places, but this is an example which is becoming more and more important in the 20th century. Later on, we're going to make use of a time-dependent 21st century. Later on, we're going to make use of a time-dependent Gaussian random variable, eta of t. Eta of t is supposed to be a very rapidly varying quantity with a time integral which behaves like a Gaussian random variable. So I'm going to tell you what eta of t is. I'm going to tell you what eta of t is on the blackboard. And I'm going to describe its properties. A few words to go with this. The words are that rapidly varying Gaussian variables like eta of t are used all over the place in stochastic differential equations. For example, the equations that are used to analyze the behavior of financial markets. Eta of t has two important properties. Eta of t has an average which is zero, and eta of t times eta of s, the average of this is gamma, some normalization factor, times the delta function of t minus s. That plus the statement that the integral from s to t du of eta of u is a Gaussian variable defines everything you want to know about eta. And once you have that, you can stick eta into a differential equation. We will do that but when we talk about Brownian motion. We will do that because we are going to talk about a particle, here it is, being hit by tons of little particles. And the momentum picked up by the big particle as it is hit by the little particle will be described by eta of t. I guess I have saved the mathematics of that later on. And so this is all I want to say about that. Please do. The time derivative of the logarithm of the price of a security is supposed to be of the form eta of t times a number which is called the volatility of the stock. You analyze the price of the security on the basis of that. You and everybody you know analyzes it on the basis of this equation, and you all get into trouble together. Well, there are several reasons why you get into trouble. One is that this is a decent empirical equation, but doesn't take into account the fact that you and all your buddies are doing it, so that it's a product of fashion. And when the fashion changes, the equation that the security satisfies is going to change. It also doesn't take into account the fact that there are deviations from Gaussian behavior that are not included in this equation. which are particularly important when there are large excursions from the behavior given by this equation. So when there is something that goes wrong with this, it goes wrong in a big way. You and your buddies all together get discouraged with this equation. You all get panicky. You all sell or buy or do something or other together. And whoosh, the market goes to hell. You start out with this, and its consequence for the price of the security, which is called the Black-Scholes equation and is a Gaussian behavior for the logarithm of the price of the security. Everybody learns Black-Scholes either in business school or as they are getting their PhD in physics and wonder where the next job is coming from. And when everybody learns it, we find ourselves with a little bit of trouble in the world. Question, comment? Yes, please.
Look up information about it.
I've now been talking for 70 minutes. My mind has dribbled out through my mouth, and I have I'm not making contact.
Okay.
Look up stochastic differential equation.
Okay. Thank you.
And you'll find it almost certainly on Wikipedia. Look up Wiener measure.
Oh, thank you.
This reappears in discussions of path integrals when you're talking about things that wiggle a lot. And in the discussions of path integrals and of the probabilities that one uses for the path integrals, Wiener measure appears. And that's where you, that's another place that you're going to find it. One question. You got a second?
Oh, well, the second was exactly, I was wondering if there's a measure that would give you an actual example of an eta, but I'm so assuming that that's the Wiener measure.
Okay. I'm looking for a physical example.
Or not so a physical example.
Look under a microscope at a little particle of pollen. That particle of pollen undergoes a dance. You look at the momentum of that and ask how it changes in time, and it changes. Its momentum obeys is something like this, with a coefficient in front. Or you look at the price of a stock, of the logarithm of the price of the stock is a little better. It looks something like this. In fact, this is a limiting case of things which wiggle rapidly, and limiting case of things which wiggle rapidly and are Gaussian. It's a mathematical device, just in the same sense that a delta function is a mathematical device. You asked me for an example of a delta function. That's very big is at one point. You asked me for a mathematical example of this stochastic variable. I will say it's something that wiggles very rapidly. Okay, the next thing I will do in the next lecture, let me just set it up, and then, I guess we have enough time to finish it off. I want to talk about how you do an integration in which you have a M, capital M, that appears in the integrand and the exponential of the integrand, and we're talking about the limit as m goes to infinity. F of x is some decent function, and it goes through a single largest maximum in the interval between a and b. And we're trying to do the integral from a to b of an integral dx e to the m times f of x, where f of x has a single maximum in that interval between a and b. We're looking at the limit as m goes to infinity. The exponential varies over a huge range, and the integral appears to be very difficult. It appears to be particularly difficult if an I appears in it someplace, and not only does it go to infinity, but in fact it's wiggling a lot. But in the end, it's easy. The main contribution will come at the maximum value of f in the closed interval between a and b. Assume that there is a unique maximum, and that the second in the interior of the interval, and that the second derivative exists there. For definiteness, say the maximum occurs at x equals 0, that just gives me a place to put it, and that 0 is between a and b. Then we can expand the exponent and evaluate the integral in the following way. The integral is the value of the integrand at x equals 0, and then there is no, since the thing is a maximum, f prime of x is 0 at x equals 0. The first term you get out of the expansion is f double prime, and the expansion looks like the exponential of m times f double prime at 0 times x squared over 2. Since it's a maximum, f double prime is negative. I'm assuming that the thing is real, but the formulas work quite well in other cases. And so this is a Gaussian integration. I can take the limits of integration to minus infinity and infinity, because in fact, if m is very large, the contributions at these endpoints will be much, much smaller than the contribution at 0. I can then do the integration, since I know how to do any Gaussian integration, and I will get this answer. Notice that because we've assumed that that 0 is a maximum, the second derivative is negative, so the answer is real. Because m is large and positive, we don't have to include any further and higher order terms in x. For the same reason, as I already said, we can extend the limits of integration to infinity. With that, it's all done. Eventually, we will have to calculate the integral of dx from minus pi over 2 to pi over 2 of cosine of x e to the I k x, cosine of x raised to the mth power, m going to infinity. Depending on what you want to do, we can either do that integration asymptotically now or later on. It's up to you. You're organizing the homeworks. With that, I've finished this second series of lectures. That is, in 2 days, I have done what I thought would take me 3, which means I have to be a busy little beaver and write stuff for you all. But that's because you're so good, and I'm glad to see you so good. And we are 3 minutes after the hour, and no, we started 3 minutes late. We're right at the time we should be finishing, and we're right at the time we should take a break and be ready for lunch.